this is indeed Connections. Good Friday morning to you, and it is Good Friday, March 30th, 2018. I'm Roger Wendell, and for the next hour, we're going to be chatting about population. And that little piece there was from Paul McCartney, Too Many People. My guest joining me by phone is Edwin Rubenstein. He's Director of Research for Negative Population Growth Incorporated. He's also president of ESR Research and is an experienced business researcher, financial analyst, economics journalist, and author. Edwin's essays on public policy have appeared in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, Harvard Business Review, Investor's Business Daily, Newsday, and National Review. His TV appearances include Firing Line, Bill Moyers, McNeil Lear, CNBC, and Debates, Debates. Mr. Rubenstein has a BA from Johns Hopkins and a graduate degree in economics from Columbia University. Edwin Rubenstein, good morning. Welcome to KGNU.
Good morning, Roger. How are you?
Good. Good to have you here. In looking over your work and that of negative population growth, there's a lot of information about economics, the birth rate for millennials, immigration, renewable energy, and how a smaller U.S. population can save the planet. So I hope we can address all of that and even more. But first, tell us a bit about Negative Population Growth, the organization.
Well, it's an organization founded by a man whose name is Don Mann, and he founded it, I think, in the mid-70s. And they are dedicated to reducing the rate of population in the United States. There are many good reasons for that, environmental, economic, even social, and they touch all those bases in the process of researching the issue and publishing these papers that I've been contributing to in the last couple years.
I know that some of the papers that you've written and some of what's on the NPG website talk a lot about the goal being to optimize per capita income and wealth for all. How does that fit in as far as reducing population?
Well, that's a very good question. I am an economist, and I am at odds with so many in my profession because I think that our obsession with GDP and the growth in GDP is completely misplaced. GDP, is, of course, is the total size of the economy. I think a much more relevant metric, so to speak, for measuring economic growth should be GDP per capita, which is what the average person has in the way of income and ability to purchase products that for themselves and their family. And it turns out that our population growth is great for business, but it's bad for people, people who derive their income from wages. The more people you have, the more labor. That's not good for the average wage of the average worker in this country. On the other hand, of course, the more people, the more the better for businesses. They want to sell products. The more people, the lower the wage of the average worker, which is good for profits, for the most part. So there's a sort of a conflict of interest, you might say, between the business community and ordinary Americans. And that, I believe, is what Donald Trump tapped into when he attacked, immigration and the other populist agenda that he's very much involved in.
I don't mind focusing for a moment here or two on America's population and economy and those kind of things, but also looking forward to talking about world economy and the biosphere and just the planet in general in addition to this. But as we speak now, you bring up Trump, and I'm certainly not a Trump supporter, but aren't things at the moment going relatively well for the average worker? I'm under the impression that wages are up and everybody's working who wants to, or is that maybe that's not correct?
Well, wages are up, but relative to previous economic expansions, there's been very little increase in the average wage for average workers. And, there is some indication that the influx of immigrant workers may be part of that problem. There are certainly economists that find that every percentage increase in immigration in the workforce leads to a decline in the relative income of native-born workers in the United States, or at least, if not an absolute decline, a reduction in the increase that would have obtained had we not had immigrants coming into the economy and working. The evidence is on mixed on both sides of that issue, but of course people have agendas and they have a narrative that is agreeing with what their particular point of view is. I think it's pretty clear that we really don't need more people in this country, and we probably reached a point where the resources are going to be strained, and certainly if you're concerned about climate change, which is more of a global issue than something that the United States can deal with itself, certainly, it's clear that we are the most egregious emitter of CO2 per capita than any country in the world. I mean, many times what other countries produce per capita, that's because we're the richest country in the world per capita. And if we're serious about saving the planet, we have to do something about U.S. population, and that means curtail immigration into this country by some. We can do that. I'm not in favor of doing what China did, imposing a one child restriction on Native American women. I think that's a terrible way to go, and it's un-American, but we can address the population issue in this country by other means, and immigration has to be part of that discussion, I believe.
Okay, and we can look at that in more depth, but you bring up some other good points that kind of piqued my interest. China, didn't they abandon their one-child policy? Where are they at today? Do we have any idea?
Yes. Yeah, well, I mean, I believe that they abandoned it a couple years ago. Now you can have two children. The reason they did that, of course, is that they have an aging population. And they have a, I guess, pension system that I don't know exactly how it works, but the dependency rate, if that increases, that puts strain on their ability to provide for retirees. I mean, and we're facing the same issue here with Social Security. There's a perception that the more people you have coming in, the better it is for the stability and the solvency of the public welfare, the public retirement systems in these countries. But that's in many sense not the way it really works, because at least in this country, a lot of the people that are coming in, immigrants, are older people. Immigrants are able to sponsor their parents that they left behind in their native countries, so the idea that we're going to get new workers, young workers, that'll be able to pay the benefits should go to the older workers, that is a misperception. And it's Social Security in this country has become sort of a Ponzi scheme. We have to blow the whistle on this eventually and try to address it by changing the mechanics of the system rather than simply putting more people into the system.
But regardless of whether it's immigrants or my wife and I having five children or however the population increases, isn't it a fact, though, that our economy and capitalism in general has to have growth? In fact, our governor here, Governor Hickenlooper, a week or two ago, was quoted as saying, if you're not growing, you're shrinking and dying. I'm kind of paraphrasing him. I don't remember the exact quote. But in fact, he said, if you're not growing, you're going the wrong way. Isn't that what capitalism is all about?
Well, yes. The business community certainly believes that, and they're very much in favor of growth. But as I said, if you look at other countries, Japan being the most egregious example, they have a very low population growth, but their per capita income is growing much more rapidly than we are. So they are in much better shape, you know, on a per capita basis than we are, even though their population and their GDP growth is much lower than we are. Than we have. So I think if you really look at the statistics, the global picture, you'll find that countries that are growing rapidly in terms of GDP and population are not doing so well in terms of their per capita income. So, and that, to me, is the bottom line for any economy. How are you providing for the average person in that economy? How is he faring? You know, the people, the top 1%, the people who own businesses and derive a lot of their income from, you know, stocks and bonds, things that rise or fall with profits, they're doing very well. But the average person in this country is certainly not doing as well as he or she should be had we been able to control the influx into the to the labor force of immigration, and most of that increase is coming from abroad these days.
Yeah, and I want to talk about actual numbers and sustainability and sustainable levels of population here in just a minute or two. But you keep capturing my interest here. You mentioned Japan, and I've had the good fortune to spend some time there recently. I've got a family member that lives there. They, in my opinion, my unscientific sampling of my trips through Japan is they're doing quite well. They seem very comfortable and secure to me. But while I'm there, they often lament that they don't have enough young people, that people are not having enough babies, and that they want more. It just, they seem to be at odds with themselves. Can you comment on that?
Well, that's probably there's a global problem with an aging. The world is getting older, Roger. Relatively speaking, there are more people over 65 than ever before, and that the percentage of the total population over 65 is slated to increase dramatically over the next by mid-century. It's a universal. Well, is it a problem? It's probably related, I think, to the gradual increase in affluence all over the world. You know, one of the reasons that women in this country are having fewer children is that it's simply the cost of raising a child is growing much faster than the incomes of families. It's simply an economic response to the cost of providing for the things that you have to provide, in most notably education, of course. You know, we all know that the tuition expenses, which, believe me, when people decide to have children, they are already calculating how much it will cost to educate those kids in colleges and universities in this country. That's a tremendous disincentive to have more than one or two kids, because that's you know, the tuition costs are rising much, much more rapidly than incomes, that calculus is we find that more and more around the world. Now, in some countries that are very low have a very low level of economic development. I mean, I'll throw out some names: Bangladesh, Sudan. They are not, their growth rates, population growth rates, are very high. And they are mainly agricultural countries, very low level of literacy in those countries. There's very low access to contraception in many cases in those countries. And also the infant mortality rate is very high in those countries still, you know, despite all the right medical advances. So they have to have, in those countries, having a large family is sort of like an insurance policy. That is your social insurance, your retirement insurance. You expect to be cared for by your children. And you may lose a lot of them just in the early ages. So to insure yourself in your own old age, you try to have as many kids as you can. And obviously, that works against what we are striving for, which is a reduction in population growth. But, it's just a factor of low development, low education, and there are probably reasons in the upper echelons of government in those countries why they allow that to persist. But it's certainly damaging to their ecosystem and to the world's ecosystem, because more people, the more CO2 is emitted. It doesn't matter where you are. You can be in Bangladesh or the Sudan. It's the CO2 migrates all over the world, and it produces the global warming that is very much a problem. It will be a bigger problem as we go forward.
Okay, you bring up these other countries. So another good point is, what's the current world population, and kind of compare and contrast that with the past? I know you do that on your website, npg.org. Talk about how much growth has taken place since 1900. Fill us in on that.
I don't have those numbers in front of me. I think the world's population is...
It's about 7.5 million, Your website emphasizes that the population has basically tripled since 1900 worldwide, and that it had never seen that kind of growth in the entire length of human history. So, in other words, a lot of people.
There may be more people. Yeah, I heard one statistic, and I don't know if this is NPG or not, but there are more people living today than there have been people born in, in the last 1,000 years or so. In other words, we've reached, it's the power of exponential increase. You reach a point where things are growing at an absurdly high rate of growth. I'm sure that's very likely to have transpired in the last few years. I mean, since World War II, I think, economic development has spread around the world, and the growth in the population is probably great. But again, I say, people who are struggling don't have as many children as they used to. And certainly, we see that in this country, and it's the same thing abroad. But again, we still have a great swath of mankind living in poverty. And that's where the population growth is occurring.
But yet we're led to believe that a rising tide raises all boats. In other words, China and Japan, U.S., Europe are doing pretty well economically. Isn't the basic poverty level worldwide, being reduced as a result? We're all doing better.
Well, it's funny. China, of course, was doing very well because it was perceived to be the low-cost producer in the world. Their wages were low. Walmart, they buy most of their stuff. I mean, they're the largest importer of goods from China in the world. But as China has become more affluent, they are losing market share to countries like Bangladesh and Sri Lanka and maybe parts of India that are even have lower incomes than they do. So it's a sort of a, in the long run, if those countries grow economically, that would be good for global population growth. Now, that would retard global population growth for the simple reason that as they get richer, their family size will have fewer children, and so it'll be sort of a virtuous cycle. We could be surprised with much lower population growth as these other poorer countries, benefit from the relative affluence in the countries like China and I don't know about India. I think there's India is a country, by the way, that is still, although their GDP has grown rapidly, it hasn't been distributed among the people nearly as much as it is in China. So they are still experiencing very, very high population growth rates. You know, they expect India will have as large a population as China within a few decades, I believe. And, you know, they'll both be in the 1 billion plus category soon, if they're not already.
Right. No, I think they're at about 1.3 billion each. And, you bring up an interesting point. You know, luckily I've been able to visit both countries, and India seems to have a lot more poverty, you know, that I encountered than my travels through China, although Western mm-hmm. China is pretty impoverished. And, of course, they've taken right. by force Xinjiang and Tibet, which are whole other radio shows in themselves. But one of the questions that comes to mind is, thankfully, you and I are having this conversation, at least I'm thankful for it, because I get a little bit frustrated with traffic and all the crowds wherever I go on this continent and elsewhere. You know, it's kind of an unscientific sampling, but I get the feeling that things are getting a little bit crowded. But besides me whining about traffic on I-25 here in Colorado, I don't hear anybody ever mention population problems. I don't hear it from environmentalists, certainly mm-hmm. never from politicians, activists. Why is that? Why is it we don't hear anybody talking about the population problem?
Well, you know, if I could be a cynical observer of this, it gets back to the politicians are dependent on their donors, you know, which means mainly business people. And business people, I don't care what they say publicly, but when the doors are closed, behind closed doors, they do not favor a reduction in population. They do not want to see illegals deported, because, frankly, that would simply reduce their bottom line. They need the cheap labor to increase profits. It's good for them. They reduce their major cost, which is the labor cost, and they sell stuff to these people. So there's a conflict of interest there between, you know, again, between the ordinary man and the man who has the ear of politicians. That's one of the reasons, as I said at the beginning, that's why Donald Trump is in the White House, because he spoke to the ordinary man the way, and said things that everyone says, but not not necessarily in public. He's very cleverly parlayed that insight into a political career. I am not at all optimistic that the business community will ever relinquish their addiction, you might say, to cheap labor, which they get through immigration, and larger market place that which they also get from immigration. You know, you increase revenues by having more people to sell to, and you reduce your expenses by having poorer workers to pay. It's a win-win for the business people, but it's the average American could be much better off if our population wasn't growing as rapidly as it is.
And, you know, certainly I understand what you're saying about the business perspective of this, but here's an example I just thought of. In preparing for the show, I ran across a couple of news releases where monarch butterfly count, the annual monarch butterfly count in California, is down to 200,000 monarch butterflies this year, as opposed to 1.2 million butterflies 20 years ago. Now, we're not doing a butterfly show here, but what's interesting to me is they didn't address human population as being the primary effect of this. So this was not a business news release. This was scientific. Butterfly populations are down dramatically, but yet absolutely no mention that, maybe it could be the 1/3 billion people living in America. Your take on that?
Well, look, I think it's even broader than that. It's the monarchs. I suspect this is probably a global phenomenon.
Oh,
I don't know if monarchs found Pardon? It's global.
No, certainly there's a global problem. There's population declines of all species, loss of species planet-wide.
But,
you know, the point I'm getting at is every time I hear that a species is going extinct, you know, they usually attribute it to population or overgrazing or whatever, but nobody ever mentions population.
Well, Roger, I think you're on to something. People think that global warming is very bad, but they also think that somehow we're going to muddle through this. And, you know, again, if you want to, I had breakfast with one of my relatives a few weeks ago, a very smart woman, and we started talking about, you know, the environment. And in New York, you're always aware of the environment. And she said, "Oh, you know, we're renewable energy is going to that's going to save us. So I don't worry much about global warming." And I think politicians have sort of they like to talk that way because, frankly, they don't want to restrict population growth for the reasons I discussed. The people who donate to their campaigns are very much in favor of population growth, but the point is that renewable energy sources, although they're clean and they don't emit CO2, so they're good for global warming, that is, they reduce the rate of global warming, but they're simply incapable of changing the direction of the CO2 intensity of our atmosphere. With all the hype of wind and solar and all these green energy sources, today we only have 10% of our energy supplies through renewable energy sources. And my research indicates that it's virtually impossible for renewables to achieve the kind of reduction in carbon dioxide that is needed to stem the sort of inexorable increase in CO2 in the atmosphere and the increase in global temperatures. There, for many reasons, it's technically it's just impossible for that to happen. So we are left with one major lever to deal with, and that is population growth. Only if we reduce the number of people in this country and indeed on the planet, ultimately, can we assure ourselves that the climate will not increase. We won't have these terrible catastrophes of weather and temperature and that we see already seeing, you know, much more frequently than we had a few years ago. And I think this is really a beginning of a long-term trend in that we really haven't come to grips with yet. So, but, you know, no politician wants to say we have to reduce population. That is not a winning agenda. That's our problem, really.
I want to talk about this renewable idea a little bit more. It's a little bit discouraging, but I'm skeptical of that. But let's take a moment. I want to remind listeners you're listening to KGNU, rather. I'm Roger Wendell, and my guest by phone this morning is Edwin Rubenstein. He's Director of Research for Negative Population Growth Incorporated. Time is 9:01. This is KGNU Boulder, KGNU Denver. And we're going to open up the phone lines here in just a minute. People are already calling in. We're at 303-442-4242. Again, if you have a question or want to join the conversation, we're opening up the lines. Nancy's standing by the phones at 303-442-4242. Ed, want to back up? Ed, if you don't mind, I'll back up a little bit here. I want to talk about this renewable idea. To me, it's counterintuitive. You're suggesting that if we get more and more involved in renewables, it's not going to have much impact on atmospheric CO2. Is that what you're saying?
Well, they help. But the problem is so large that We might have reached pushed the envelope as far as we can go on renewables, and a lot of these renewables are exacerbating the output of CO2. I mean, you know, the renewable industry, they've done a good job of marketing themselves, but if you really get into what they involve, you find that even the wind and solar are not really renewables. The only pure renewable that we have that emits no CO2 is water power, and it's just inconceivable that we can run everything on water power.
Well, how is it
not going to happen?
You know, I mean to challenge you here a little bit. I don't know as much about renewables as I should, but my instincts tell me there's not a lot of carbon emissions from wind or even photovoltaics. But you're saying the opposite.
Well, first of all, they take a lot First of all, wind is not a stable power source. We can agree on that, and neither is
solar. Agreed.
Right? They come and they go. So how do you mitigate that problem? Well, you need a lot of storage. Storage like you don't could never wrap your hands around.
I know they experiment with like storing large bodies of water at a higher elevation when the wind power is strong, and then draining it at night to generate more electricity. I know it's inefficient, but it is storage.
Well, Roger, and we have 90% of our energy at this time still produced by fossil fuels. Okay, so now that's the problem. How do we get to zero? Because as long as there's any CO2 emitted, we're going to face a climate change conundrum. So we still have time to do it, but we're not going to do it with renewables. They require a lot of infrastructure. They require a lot of land. Now, if you were to store the amount of energy from wind or solar that you have to store, you would take literally thousands of square miles of territory. I mean, thousands of square miles.
A lot of territory, certainly.
A lot of territory. And in the process, you would cut down trees and cover up grasslands that cleanse the atmosphere. So, you know, it would be you would be removing one of the great natural phenomenon, photosynthesis, that cleans the atmosphere. When you depend on renewable energy, you have to every kilowatt of energy has to be backed up by a fossil fuel, because you know especially if you're a company, a solar energy company, you can't simply rely on solar energy. You have to have the wherewithal to import fossil fuel from other parts of the country in order to remain in business and have your customers be assured that the power will be there for them. So, you know, you have to have these fossil fuels online in order to provide services like that. And that's, you know, and when you do need them, if you have to increase their output rapidly, that's causes a very big spike in CO2 emissions. There's no free lunch here with renewables. You have to have the capability of providing power every minute, no matter what happens to the sunlight or the wind. And that's a very that in itself is a process that requires a lot of CO2 be available to meet that demand.
Okay. Well, we have full lines. I'll get to the phones in just a moment. But one thing I you made me think of, though, in regards to this, the embedded energy or the that's used to actually manufacture the wind turbines or the photovoltaic cells. Apparently, it's very energy intensive to create these things.
Yes. Well, that process of going down, a lot of it's created, I think it's a lot of it's made in China, actually, the cells.
Everything is made in China, certainly.
Yes, well, it's very cheap.
I'm a proponent of this. I use solar panels at home, not exclusively,
right.
But I power a portion of my house with solar panels. But, you know, it's an expensive undertaking and battery maintenance and all of that.
And the way I understand it, and I've never had solar power, but I understand that if you have 2 weeks of cloudy weather, you can always switch seamlessly to the local power plant.
I run an extension cord over to my neighbor's house. But anyway, no, just
that's
joking. Mike's been waiting a long time. Let's go to the phones. Mike, you're on Connections. Good morning.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yep, hear you well.
Hey. Great program. My only complaint would be that you don't have at least 2 or 3 hours on this. This is you guys have opened a veritable can of worms, but this kind of goes back to the old Thomas, I guess his first name was Thomas Malthus, Malthus's population theories and stuff. But the crux of the thing lies, you know, in the economic paradigm. And, I was born in the 50s, and my grandfather was a miner, coal miner, before the United Mine Workers was established and was treated like crap, worked 7 days a week. And if you got hurt, you're out of luck, you know, 12 hours a day. So, you know, the current economic paradigm certainly doesn't value people without the political input that we have. And we do see places like Norway and, you know, Sweden and Denmark and to some extent, I guess, Finland, too, which is actually has a better free market economy than the United States. But they very much limit their population as it is. I mean, they do have some immigration, but, you know, those are small countries, and they're already looking at this. So far as population control, we're not going to stop, you know, people from reproducing in most of the third world, you know, Asia particularly. We have no control. But so far as our own American economy, just to put it in perspective, Germany, which, you know, I was lucky enough been able to go there, but they have a population of about 80 million people inside the same geographic territory, roughly, of Montana, the state of Montana, which I believe has still less than 1 million people. So we do have a lot of room for growth. And, you know, Germany is one of the largest producers of solar panels and those technologies in the world, and they have kind of a cloudy personal climate, but they're way ahead of us. So the thing with population is that you can't stop people from breeding. It's built right into them. And just because it doesn't happen in the United States with population growth, let's say that we secured our borders completely and we adopted a brand new economic paradigm, which is highly unlikely, but at least with current political system, which is bought and paid for by the corporations, we're not going to even begin to get a handle on this. But it's a no-brainer that the more people, even in a nuclear family, you know, I have a friend that grew up in Spanish Harlem in Chicago, 11 siblings, you know, his mom loved them all, but geez, there's only so much time. So it's a no-brainer that the more people, the less that they're valued as they should be individually. And the economic system that we have cares not one whit about the people. And your main thesis on the GDP per individual, that's what we need to calculate. But I'm going to get off the line. Great conversation. Do a part two of this, please.
Okay, we'll do
Thank you.
Hey, thanks, Mike. Edwin, your response.
Well, I mean, I basically agree with him. I think the politics is very much against population control in this country. I think we will never tell women how many children to have. But as I said, I think as we get richer, there is a natural tendency to consider the cost of raising a child as being one of the primary factors that feed into the decision to have a child. And those costs are very high. We all know that. They're not getting lower, and they're certainly increasing faster than the incomes of people. So I suspect that, you know, our population, if you look at the fertility rate of American women, since the Great Recession, it has plunged. It has plunged. It's amazing how quickly these things turn around. Our women are having babies at less than the rate that they would have to sustain in order to replicate the population. In other words, if we were to continue having this drop in fertility that has transpired since the Great Recession, actually, only in the last 10 years, eventually we would have negative population growth. Negative, not just reduced, but negative. Now, it takes some time for that to happen because you have to it requires a reduction in the number of women who are in the childbearing ages. But we're on the way to that situation. And in fact, it's really, right now, it's only immigration that is preventing the population from falling. That's the projection of the Census Bureau, and there's no reason to think that they're going to fudge those numbers. If people want a reduction in population, you know, we are doing our best in this country to achieve that. It's the people coming in from abroad that are sort of dominating the population change these days, and
let's talk about that here for just a moment. We'll go back to the phones in a minute. Rick, Julian, and Strider and others are waiting patiently. We appreciate that. We have one open line at 303-442-4242. Edwin, I know from your website, Negative Population Growth, Inc., the site claims that 70% or more of America's population growth comes from immigration, both legal and illegal. Is that where it's at?
Yes, and the census is projecting that by mid-century, 2050, it'll be 82%. In other words, 82% of the population growth in the year 2050 will be from people coming in from abroad, and only that means 18% will be from what they call the natural increase, that is the difference between births and deaths in the United States. So, depending upon whether you believe that a reduction in population is necessary or not, that would inform whether you believe immigration is necessary or
not. What is a good number for the U.S. population? What's sustainable? How many Americans should there be, and what should immigration be?
Well, I think let me give you some perspective. Right now, legal immigration is the much larger problem, if you will, it's much larger than illegal immigration. We are letting in about more than a million people legally every year, and another 200,000 come in, or a couple hundred thousand come in as refugees, recently. So and on the other hand, 300,000 immigrants leave the country every year. So, if you were to say what is the optimal level of immigration,
Optimal level of immigration and population. We're at a third billion. We have 1/3 billion people in this country. What should that number be?
I think the gentleman who called before said, Germany has, in an area the size of Montana has 80 million people.
Right.
I don't want to wait until we are as crowded as some of the European countries. I would like to stabilize population cutting back on immigration so that the level we reach a level of zero net immigration. That would put us down to a level of 300,000 to 400,000 people coming in every year, as opposed to the million plus that we have now. I mean, that would create a stable foreign-born population in this country.
Fair enough, 200 to 300,000 then immigrants. But what's right. the ideal number of people living in this country? Like, it's doubled in my lifetime. We're at a third billion people now. What's a good number? 200 million, 150 million? What makes it sustainable and gives us a good quality of life? What number?
We're at, 300 and some 20 million? I think 200 million would be very, very sustainable, very easy. You wouldn't have traffic jams on the way to work. And okay. by the way, those I think the internet will take care of that anyway, because you'll be commuting from your second bedroom rather than going to work. You know, it's the
okay. Well, we put a number on it. We got a lot of people waiting to join the conversation. Rick's been waiting the longest. Rick, good morning. You're on Connections.
Well, hi there. Can you hear me?
Yep, we can hear you.
All right. Well, great. I really enjoy this program, and very glad to have this speaker on here. And I want to ask your speaker, I'm a teacher of economics myself. I teach environmental economics at Front Range, but I put a lot of ecological economics into my course. They won't let me teach a course just in ecological economics because there's no demand for it yet, but I think it's really the economics of the future, and I wondered if your speaker, as an economist, if he has heard of this, and I think that the teaching of economics should be part and parcel of how we start to change the paradigm. I think trying to have a political debate just on population growth alone is very, very difficult, and it makes more sense if you integrate it as how you integrate it into your economy and how you teach economics. And really what ecological economics does, it's really the blending of ecology and economics. Economics historically grew up without including the environment. Ecology grew up as a science without including Homo sapiens, and it's really just natural that they start to come together. And one of the first principles of ecological economics is scale. It's hard to say what the optimal number is, but if you simply include it as scale of your population in relation to your environment, is very important. So, and this whole fascination with growth coincided completely with fossil fuel. And so if you could answer that, that'd be great. I'll take my question off here.
All right, Rick, thank you. Edwin, your response to Rick.
Oh, I absolutely agree. You know, as I said, economists are obsessed with GDP. I mean, no number is scrutinized more carefully, more obsessively than the increase in GDP from one quarter to the next. Now, GDP simply is a measurement of all the goods and services that are produced in a certain frame of time in the United States. But what about the bads? You know, goods are one thing. What about the bads? What about the CO2 that's emitted? What about the increase in diseases that are related to global warming, the loss in habitat, that the increase in extreme weather patterns, the destruction that we've seen? So we have to have another metric to juxtapose to GDP, which would be a reduction from GDP. We don't have that now, and I think, you know, it's certainly doable. And if the gentleman who called, he's teaching the economics of the ecosystem. People like him are the ones who should be developing a metric that we could juxtapose to GDP to see how we really stand as far as not just goods and services, but the bads that are created by our economic system. And if we were to observe both of these things over time, we'd see that, you know, we have to work on the bads, reduce the bads, as well as increase the goods. And for far too long, we've been focusing solely on the this other side of the equation. One side of the equation. We have to be more have a broader perspective than what we have today. And I blame the economic profession for this. I mean, I am culpable. Of course, when Adam Smith wrote, and when Thomas Malthus, the gentleman mentioned, when he was writing, the beds were not. That was before the internal combustion engine was even developed. I think all the energy at that time was pretty much water power, which is very clean and very green. But of course, that's all they knew, so they didn't could never have anticipated the problems that we're facing today. But we've been, you know, it's now 200 years since the Industrial Revolution got started. And we certainly, it's about time we realize that, you know, there's more to an economy than just the goods. There's also the bads, and we have to start putting numbers on that side.
Certainly. 9:22 is the time. You're listening to Connections. My guest this morning is Edwin Rubenstein. He's Director of Research for Negative Population Growth Incorporated. We're going to go back to the phones in just a moment. But, Ed, I wanted to mention I had the good fortune 20 years ago on this program to interview Boulder Professor Al Bartlett. 20 years ago, Al asked, can you think of any problem on any scale from microscopic to global whose long-term solution is in any way aided, assisted, or advanced by having larger populations at the local level, state level, nationally, or globally? That was Al Bartlett 20 years ago.
I never had the privilege of meeting him, but I know people who have, and he's a legend in this field.
Certainly, we're very proud of him in Boulder. He's long since passed, of course.
But, right.
All right, enough of that. We'll go back to the phones. Julian has been waiting forever. Julian, you're on Connections. Good morning.
Yes, sir. Good morning. Good to hear you. Thank you. The thing that caused concern for me is the dwindling insect population that I can see when you're driving along and you don't get all the tons of insects like you used to. So this includes all the bees, all the moths, and everything that we can't even see that's being destroyed. And then in terms of alternate forms of energy, there's geothermal, and I was wondering if you think that's worthwhile pursuing along with all the other solar and wind stuff. Thank you.
Yes. Well, as far as the insect population, I think you can blame DDT for that. And, you know, Rachel Carson wrote the book Silent Spring. It's been 50 or 60 years since the profusion of flies and grasshoppers and creepy, crawly things that we all remember from our youth, at least people my age remember, that they're no longer around in the numbers that they used to be. Frankly, at that time, I don't think we were aware of the long-term implications of doing away with that, but today we certainly should be aware, and again, we have to address these issues a lot differently than we have in the past. Now, I don't know much about geothermal. You know, it's a fairly small fraction of the renewables, but I know a lot of houses are being built with heating systems that are geothermal. Frankly, I don't understand the physics of it, except that people do think it's a cleaner energy source than the traditional furnace. Roger, maybe you can enlighten me on that one.
No, I'm just the interviewer, the guy with the questions. Let's we're running short on time. We'll try to get a few more calls in here. Strider has been waiting a long time. Strider, good morning. You're on Connections.
Yeah, thank you, Roger. It'd be nice to actually have time for a real discussion someday after 30 years, but let me get some bullet points. Hazel Henderson wrote an incredible book about 25 years ago, Building a Win-Win World, Life Beyond Global Economic Warfare, and created a whole new concept of how to judge the economic health. And President Lula da Silva of Brazil was one of many national leaders who got on board with that. That's one of the reasons our system threw him out and stuff. And then they created 9/11 because people were beginning to wake up to what their problem was. But if you get distracted with a major war, you can always get away with anything. Capitalism was fairly decent for 100 years or so, but if you're building a permanently growing and increasingly growing economy on a finite planet, it, by definition, will destroy itself and or the planet. Just bullet points, a couple of more. Neoliberal economics has very consciously turned what capitalism has always done into the production of scarcity. That's its primary product, is to produce scarcity and therefore competition and war and the race to the bottom, which creates more slavery and more competition and starvation. But let me bring up the contradiction. Zero PG and immigration brings up the race question. We've already got ours, not yours, and make a racial definition. That is an absolute contradiction that we're going to have to face, and it can only be faced by building a world economy that can undermine that entire paradigm of the race to the bottom and the productive increased production on a finite planet. So
Strider,
I'll let it go.
Strider, a good point. Immigration, there's accusations of racism. Edwin, your response?
Oh, listen, I'm sure that it exists. I don't think it's a major factor in people who want to control population, but it can be very difficult to separate the two, cause since we all know that most of the influx coming in these days is from Mexico and China and the rest of Asia. It's not something that polite people want to talk about. I think there's a racist in all of us, whether we allow it to dominate our worldview is another question entirely. I think, you know, racism is part of the Darwinian plan to preserve the species. We're always wary of people who are not like us. But in a civilized society, that should not be a major consideration. I mean, if we're the rule of law, and if people obey the law, we should welcome them. That's mine. I don't want to get involved. Okay. You know,
Unfortunately, we're almost out of time, Edwin.
Right.
My apologies to Wendy and the other callers we missed. We're just out of time. What's a good way folks can learn more about Negative Population Growth Incorporated and your work? I know you've written quite a bit about economics and population. Where can we learn more?
Well, you can go first to the NPG website, and it's, you'll find a lot of material. And if you subscribe, if you send a few bucks their way, they will send you emails on a regular basis informing you as to what's going on in this field. They're quite enlightening. They have a lot of subscribers, and I recommend anyone who is interested in this topic to become involved with them. They're one of the few people who are actually actively lobbying for a actual reduction in U.S. population. So that makes us unique, I think, in the spectrum of ecological politics in this country.
All right, Edward, we're completely out of time. We could have used another couple of hours on this. We'll have to have you back on the air sometime soon.
That would be great.
Okay, great.
Thank you, Roger.
Yep, my guest has been Edwin Rubenstein. He's Director of Research for Negative Population Growth Incorporated. I'm Roger Wendell. You've been listening to Connections. We want to thank everybody for their support during our on-air drive last week. This is your community radio station, KGNU Denver Boulder. Big thanks to Nancy. Up next is Dave with the Morning Sound Alternative. We'll see you all next Friday.
Thank you.